Welcome to Disrespect, exploring the stigma around disability, providing information and interviews to entertain and challenge listeners who care about, or care for, or may themselves have become someone with a disability. Disrespect welcomes to the show today Professor Ernie Lightman from University of Toronto to talk to us about housing. Dr. Lightman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Lightman, you're very well qualified. What are some of the reports that you've done?
Well, a number of years ago, under the NDP government, I was a one-person commission of inquiry looking into what we now call care homes,
right.
Boarding homes, retirement homes, things like that.
You collaborated on that 3D report. What was it, diverted, discouraged, and disentitled?
Yes, oh yes, of course, I forgot about that.
All right, yeah.
Well, at present, I'm the principal investigator on a big project funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council,
right.
SHRC,
right.
And we're looking at welfare, work-to-welfare programs, workfare in Ontario,
okay.
And as part of that, we're looking at the housing that's available to people in Ontario. But the project that was funded largely only looks at people who are on Ontario Works.
Oh.
ODSP was not, we didn't ask for funding for that, and we weren't funded to do that.
Oh.
And this year, I have a practicum student who is looking specifically at the people we've been interviewing who have disabilities and should qualify for ODSP, but have been unable to get on the program, and stuck on OW.
Very interesting group.
Yes, absolutely.
With what organization and in what relative time frame could we look forward to a report from that study?
Well, the material that we've done already is available on the web, and I can give the website.
Okay.
www.socialwork, mm-hmm. that's one word, socialwork.utoronto.ca /SANE, S-A-N-E. That's
right.
The name of our project, Social Assistance in the New Economy. We use the acronym S-A-N-E.
The approach to disability housing in this province is a rather strange one. It's that disabilities are a physical phenomenon and that one can provide for disabilities by varying the dimensions of housing. And there seems to be no provision for things like environmental allergies. There seems to be no provision for people who require supports but not full-time care. Those kinds of disability issues seem to have gone neglected. And there are a lot of disabled people, probably a million, who would qualify as disabled but choose not to go on benefits or maybe still working in some way.
Or can't get onto benefits.
Yes, people who can't get onto benefits and are on welfare and classified as unemployed.
Yep.
Isn't a million a significant voter block, or is this a blind spot in the government, or is this just part of their strategy that this block just doesn't swing the vote?
Well, in the first place, I think the million number, I have a sense you probably pulled it out of the air.
Yeah, I know that people tend not to self-identify as disabled. So
yes.
If they're 200,000 on benefits, then there are those who self-identify who are not on benefits.
Yeah.
And then there's probably, at least an equal number who don't prefer to think of themselves that way. And so, yeah, to a certain sense, I pulled it out of the air, but not
but,
without
but
some perspective.
It's not an implausible number. I think there has always been, going back to the poor laws of Victorian England, or maybe earlier, there's been what we refer to as a hierarchy of deservedness.
All right.
Meaning we place moral worth on people in ranking priority.
Right.
Within the world of disability, there is a similar hierarchy of deservedness. And people with physical disabilities are at the top of that list. And the government have always been more responsive and receptive to dealing with issues for people with physical disabilities than they have for a psychiatric survivor.
There are metabolic disabilities, too. Things like MS don't show up as physical for a long, long time, but they have, in the meantime, they have motor and cognitive effects that are disabling but aren't easily seen.
Yes, well, and until they're seen, they aren't recognized, because if you can't see it, it doesn't exist.
Okay.
I'm sitting on a PhD committee in our department where the student is looking at women who have precisely these kinds of disabilities that are not physically or visible or identifiable.
Right.
They can't get onto any programs because their disabilities can't be identified and labeled and quantified and measured.
Right.
And therefore they can't be filled into a computer-based form that has drop-down menus because they don't fit into any of the five available categories.
Right.
I think it's fair to say that people with some of the less visible disabilities, the psychiatric disabilities as well, just don't come onto the government's radar screen.
Right.
And as you said a minute ago, many of these people don't self-identify.
I know these people, and I think they're to be admired for persevering, but it's very hard to reach them.
Yes. And I think if programs were available to them as people with disabilities, I suspect some of them would prefer not to be labeled as disabled, but would accept it in order to get the benefits. Certainly, if I was in that position, you know, if I was desperate for some kind of government program, whatever they're looking for, that's how I would try to package myself.
Well, I think the dietary benefit is a good example of that.
It is, and I was just thinking about that, actually.
Yeah.
It's an excellent example.
Where the government's characterized dietary deficits in a certain way, and yet people who are legislated to have dietary deficits feel no compunction in filing for the benefit, and the government is a little annoyed.
That's correct. Yeah, I take off my hat to OCAP that came up with the idea of using this benefit. It's a very effective initiative, particularly since the government has made it clear that they are not going to do anything to replace the 22% welfare cuts that the Harris government imposed.
They haven't raised disability rates other than the 3% or whatever that they did and that's like going on 13 years now.
Yep. And, you know, with inflation, the loss of purchasing power that's much greater than 22%.
And that includes the rental rates, too. And meanwhile, we're in the middle of a real estate boom.
Yes, that's correct.
People waiting for housing, some of them in Toronto waiting well into the teens of years on a waiting list there, and people in other communities waiting for years, must wonder how the housing system works to keep them out of subsidized housing, social housing, for so long. Is there a general point of view that you can put forward from your research and your studies?
I think there's a couple of things that are relevant here. First of all, housing is one social program that has a very long time lag. If a government made a decision and started to flow the money today,
right,
it would take a surprisingly long period of time before the first person would be housed.
Okay.
In that sense, it's very different, for example, than raising welfare rates.
All right.
And sometimes a government will decide that the best way to deal with the housing solution is to raise welfare rates rather than to directly address the housing.
Right.
Now, that doesn't usually address the problem, but the reason the government might choose to do that is because the timeline is much less.
Right.
If they make a decision to raise rates today, the increased payments can be on this month's welfare check.
Right.
In rural areas where there's a lot of housing vacancies, it's often argued that giving people money is actually just as good as building the housing, maybe better, because they can get into the housing right away. But in general, I'm not in favor of giving people money instead of the housing. I was just presenting that as an example. Even if this government had come into office and announced that housing was going to be its priority, it would take perhaps years, a couple of years, before the housing could actually be built.
Okay.
Land has to be acquired, it has to be assembled, zoning issues have to be dealt with, the housing has to be physically built. So all of that takes time. The McGuinty government has made it very clear what their priorities are. I think they are clear from throne speeches, from minister statements, from just about everything. And housing is not a high priority for them. Education is a higher priority for them. Dealing with waiting lists for certain specific types of surgery is a priority for them. And therefore, by subtraction, everything else is not a priority.
That's right.
And the condition of the poor in Ontario is clearly not been identified as a priority for this government.
Right.
So, I mean, that may be another reason why there's no housing that's emerging on the horizon. Having said that, I think this government is different from the previous government in that I don't think they are mean.
All right.
I don't think they are punitive. And I don't think they are going out of their way to beat up the poor or to punish and to blame people who are homeless.
Okay.
It's just that on their list of priorities, the condition of the poor isn't a high ranker.
And on the assumption that the poor don't vote?
I'm sure that has something to do with it, yes.
All right.
Whether that's the total story or not, you know, we'd really have to get inside Dalton McGuinty's mind or the minds of the people around him, and clearly we can't do that.
I'm not sure we'd want to.
This government, by its other actions, is showing that its focus is mainly on the middle class.
All right.
Because that are the people who they think will turn the next election one way or the other. Housing is not being built fast enough because the government chooses not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the Harris government was really very effective in demonizing all forms of public housing.
Right.
Or not-for-profit housing, let me call it that way. He labeled it all as a big scam, a big fraud, and lots of people who didn't deserve it were getting it, and he was very effective in demonizing everybody, including, you know, very middle-class people who were living in co-ops.
Right.
And I fear that that attitude, that perception of third-sector housing or not-for-profit housing still survives in the public mind to some extent. And so I think any government is going to tread very carefully before they undertake any kind of large public housing initiative in the province.
What about incentives? I mean, you know, it's one thing to plump for the cash to build public housing. It's another thing to give the existing industry incentives to invest in public housing. I don't know what kind of incentives could be created because I've seen no initiative there. There must be a reason.
But there's any number of incentives that could be created. They can range from speeded up processes to zone and things like that, to reduced taxes associated with housing, to removing the GST on housing supplies, on building supplies.
Right.
There's any number of initiatives that could be in place to encourage the private sector to build this kind of housing. And I frankly don't know why the government isn't doing more, because this kind of thing isn't tremendously costly to government in terms of taxes that it would forego through the process.
Right.
And
well, because it creates new taxes.
That's correct. That's right. And it, by creating housing, you're also creating an asset for the future. And I don't know why they're not doing that. And I frankly thought that that's what they would do. That was the kind of thing that I think that I would have predicted they would do. To some extent, they're doing it in ways that are not immediately visible to us. Like, they keep talking about speeding up the zoning process.
And oh, yeah.
Speeding up the process of approving land for development and getting rid of red tape and all that kind of stuff. And they certainly could accelerate the process of actually physically getting buildings in place through things that government can do that don't cost any money to anybody.
Right.
You know, that, like, if you simply clean up and accelerate the process of approval, for example, accelerate the approval for approved types of housing. You don't need to accelerate it for everything.
Right.
It's very easy. I mean, that kind of specific incentives governments do all the time in a variety of other areas. You know, that if you in the private sector do A, we as a government will respond by doing B.
Now, for instance, in increasing welfare rates in a tight housing market like Toronto's would tend to drive up the price of housing.
Yep.
Something like this would tend to drive it down, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because it would accelerate the process of increasing the supply.
And now we'll take a short break with the Blues.
6th Avenue Express.
Thank you.
And now, return to our interview.
This waiting system that people have to negotiate in the meantime, the conservatives introduced some changes to it, one of which was that the waiting system gives an absolute priority to abused women and doesn't give an absolute priority to any other group, such as people with environmental allergies who may find their apartment unlivable and may in fact find themselves victims of a kind of violence at the hands of a landlord who is destroying their health, to have no priority to move. Does a chronological waiting list with this kind of simple priority, is it making a lot of sense? Is it true that basically all we've produced is housing for abused women in terms of the numbers that we have? Is there only enough for them?
Well, it appears that it's getting that way.
Right.
Any government can and always will define certain priorities for the limited supply of housing. I mean, the alternative is to just put it on a queue, first come, first serve.
Right.
But I think the politics of the situation are that abused women with children are usually going to be at the top end of the list. Not necessarily because their need is greater than anybody else, but because the politics of the situation. If single mothers with kids are living in motels, as they do every now and then in Toronto, as they do regularly in Toronto, and the Toronto Star comes along with a story and lots of big pictures about how a mother with three small children is being forced to live in a sleazy motel on Kingston Road, and the kids can't even go to school, and blah, blah, blah.
I'm not laughing at the situation. It happens.
Sure it does. No, but it's very difficult for a government to resist that.
Yeah.
Someone with an environmental disability, again, it's much more amorphous, and there aren't as many of them anyways.
Right.
And at least I don't think there are.
You would think that would make a priority for them cheap, but I guess it makes the consideration for them cheap, too.
That's right. That's exactly it. Because everybody can't be a priority.
Right.
I mean, if everybody's a priority, then nobody is a priority.
Well, so, now you raise the question of the validity of a chronological fallback for the waiting list at all. I mean, a lot of people on the list, and they don't have priorities, they're just going to stay there.
That's absolutely right. If you're not near the top of the list, your chances of ever getting on are minimal, because there are other groups that are priorities. They're always going to jump to the head of the queue, and if it means that you're never going to get too far up the list. That's why the waiting list is so long.
Cities have tasked the managers of waiting lists with keeping them as short as possible, and yet there is no priority for transfer. In other words, somebody who's giving up a subsidy apartment for a different one, for a reason, can't exchange apartments. They go to the bottom of the waiting list and wait another 13 years before they get their transfer. Somebody who is transferring from a co-op to a municipal nonprofit goes to the bottom of the waiting list and waits another 12 or 13 years. How did it come to be that we, as the people who support the government, task managers with keeping the waiting list short and managing it efficiently and putting these horrific roadblocks in the way?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know the answer, but the cynic in me, the cynic in me would say that not allowing people to transfer is a way of making sure they understand that they are dependents upon the state.
Ah.
That it's a way of keeping them powerless,
okay,
and keeping them deferential, and keeping them in the status of dependence. In earlier years, when there was a huge amount of council housing in England, people used to regularly swap apartments.
Really.
And they were allowed to do that, and, you know, somebody would decide they want to go live somewhere else, and they'd find somebody and they'd trade. And there was always very bad press around it, on like the press of the right, because it said, you know, these people are dependents, they are living in public housing. What gives them the right to move around like they own the houses? We are giving them something out of the goodness of our hearts, and they should bloody well be grateful and appreciative and not challenge and not question. And I have a feeling that mentality might be there, but I don't know.
What's the future? Where's the solution?
Over the medium, longer term, the only solution available to us is to build more housing. And that is going to mean, in a city like Toronto, it inevitably is going to mean more density.
Right. More efficient use of
absolutely.
Services.
No, absolutely. And the faster we can do that, the sooner we'll be able to start to address the housing problem. Low-income people from around the province, indeed from around the country, have traditionally always migrated to Toronto, either because they see that the services are good here compared to what they are at home, or because they see that their chances of getting a job here are better than they are at home.
Yep.
The low-income population, the people who are employed in the very perilous contingent work or unemployed entirely, will continue to keep coming to Toronto, and we've got to build housing, or they're all going to wind up in slum housing that's unsafe and unfit. The solution, the future, is that we've got to build more housing. It's a time-consuming process, and probably, given the tenor of the times, a lot of that housing will have to be built with the involvement of the for-profit sector. I'm not terribly happy about that, but I think that's a political reality.
Right.
But I don't see any easy solution. I think the provincial government has talked about giving housing supplements, giving money, and in some communities, as we've been discussing, that might help address the problem.
It's very elusive. It hasn't come to pass, has it?
Well, I mean, they've introduced it, and now we have to, well, I guess there's a speech from the throne, and we have to see where this spills out when the government has its limited agenda and
right.
limited attention span, and whether this really will come to pass or not.
So this is the next step.
That's the next step, yeah.
I thank you for coming on the show today and talking to us about some of the political realities and economic realities surrounding housing.
Yep.
Test my memory. Try and repeat the site.
Yeah, www.socialwork.utoronto.ca
/SANE.
S like Sam, A, N like no, E.
All right, and we can keep our eyes on that site for continuing results of this investigation.
Yes, stuff. Everything we do now is posted there.
Good. Well, I thank you. Thank you again for your time.
And my pleasure.
We'll talk to you in the future on this subject.
Excellent. My pleasure.
All right.
At the break, you heard Big Joe Duskin from Down the Road a Piece, 6th Avenue Express. And at the end of the show, Albert Ammons from The Road to Rhythm and Blues, Volume 2, The Boogie Rocks. Thank you. Disrespect asks you to send us your requests for topics about disability discrimination, and we will air those topics in our interviews. Send your suggestion to radio.stories@gmail.com. radio.stories@gmail.com. Don't miss Toronto's Abilities Festival, the first celebration of disability arts and culture, an international artistic and cultural event showcasing excellence in the talent, vision, and passion of artists with disabilities. October 27th to October 30th, an event-packed 4 days. The Columbus Center, 901 Lawrence Avenue West at Dufferin Street. Friday and Saturday night performances at the Glenn Gould Studio, 250 Front Street West. Contact information, Abilities Festival, 70 Rose Hill Avenue, Suite 608, Toronto, M4T2W7. Telephone 416-966-0393. That's 416-966-0393. Or www.abilitiesfestival.org. Disrespect's interviews are digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.